We're going to begin today's program talking about the Irish potato famine. I want to talk about the Irish potato famine because I bet there are a lot of listeners to this program whose ancestors came from Ireland. And as you probably guessed, my immediate ancestors came from Scotland, and the Scots and the Irish have a lot in common. They both like to drink, but the Scotsmen just don't like to pay for it. Also, learning a little more about the Irish potato famine will hopefully show how much alike the United States and the European financial system are. It's as though they are run by the same people. Now let's talk about the Irish potato famine. Most people I've talked to think the famine was caused by a potato disease commonly called the potato blight, and there just wasn't enough food in Ireland to eat. These are fallacies, as you will soon recognize. Over 8 million people lived in Ireland according to the census of 1841. The Irish potato famine was the period from 1845 to 1852, and 1847 was the first year of the food crisis. During the shortage, 1.5 million Irish died, while the English feasted on fish, lamb, and beef. More people died from disease than from starvation. While the Irish population was going hungry, records show that there were as high as 50 shiploads of food a day being exported from Ireland. In 1847, almost 4,000 vessels carried food from Ireland to ports of Bristol, Glasgow, Liverpool, and London, while 400,000 Irish men, women, and children died of starvation and related diseases. Population fell by 20 to 25% due to deaths and immigration. Absentee landlords owned most of the Irish land, but visited Ireland once, twice, or never in a lifetime. The Earl of Lucan owned 60,000 acres. Middlemen collected rents on the land for the landlords, and the money was spent elsewhere. These middlemen were described as land sharks and bloodsuckers, and the most oppressive species of tyrant that ever lent assistance to the destruction of a country. Butter at that time was shipped in firkins, which held about 9 gallons. In the first 9 months of 1847, 56,557 firkins were exported from Ireland to Bristol, and 34,852 firkins were shipped to Liverpool, which correlates into a total of 822,681 firkins. That's over 7 million gallons of butter exported while the Irish starved. One reason the Irish were so famished is because they did not have enough money to obtain the food they produced, and the British government facilitated the food's exportation. The Irish writer John Mitchell wrote that no one from Ireland ever asked for charity during this period, and that it was England who sought charity on Ireland's behalf. He also accused the British press of saying that Ireland sought charity the moment Ireland fell into distress, but that it was England who passed the hat around the globe asking for a penny to relieve the Irish poor. According to legend, in 1845, the Ottoman Sultan declared his intention to send 10,000 pounds sterling to the Irish farmer, but Queen Victoria requested the Sultan send only 1,000 because she herself sent only 2,000 pounds sterling. Supposedly, the Sultan did send only 1,000 pounds sterling, just like the Queen asked him to. He also sent 3 ships full of food, and the British tried to block the ships, but the food arrived secretly and was left there by the Ottoman sailors. In 1847, a group of Choctaw Indians collected $710 and sent it to help the Irish men, women, and children. Supposedly, they did this because they remember how they themselves had suffered on the Trail of Tears. Some say the amount was really $170 instead of $710, and the $710 figure was just a misprint. By 1854, 1.5 to 2 million Irish people emigrated due to starvation and harsh living conditions. In 1847 alone, about 250,000 people left Ireland. So many emigrated to the United States during that period that by 1850, the Irish made up a quarter of the population of Boston, New York City, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, and were very prevalent in many American mining communities. Immigrants also went to Scotland, Canada, and Australia. Of the 100,000 that emigrated to Canada in 1847, 1 out of 5 died from disease and malnutrition, including over 5,000 at Grosse Island. Mortality rates of 30% aboard what was called the coffin ships were common. The Irish writer John Mitchell wrote that the Almighty indeed sent the potato blight, but the English created the famine. Stephen Zerlenga summarized the Irish potato famine best in his book, The Lost Science of Money. On pages 301 and 302, it says that the Bank of England had loaned the English government millions of pounds sterling for a century of fighting wars. Taxes were levied on the Irish landlords who exported the potatoes grown by the mostly Irish tenant farmers. Not only were the potatoes exported, but also large amounts of barley and wheat were taken from the farmers, exported, and used to pay the interest to the Bank of England. Had there been no interest to pay, the crops confiscated could have fed the entire Irish population 4 times over. But because of the interest payments, more than 1 out of 8 Irish citizens died of starvation, men, women, and children. Now let's talk about the greenbacks, which historically followed the Irish potato famine. In 1846, the Polk administration created the United States Treasury system that moved public funds from private banks to Treasury branches in an effort to stabilize the economy. However, there remained no national currency, and that was a problem of increasing urgency for a government strapped for cash. We had a tremendous growth in the decade leading up to the Civil War. McCormick alone was manufacturing 4,000 tractors a year, and there were another 100 tractor companies in this country. In 1854 and 1855, over 1 million new tons of ships were built, and this was not equaled again until 1917 during World War I. Our monetary system in 1860 was conducted by 1,606 state banks with 7,000 different kinds of banknotes circulating, and more than half of them were false, meaning that they didn't have any gold with which to redeem their notes. John J. Knox was the controller of the currency under President Grant, and he said that the history of money before the Civil War will make plain to anyone that the note-issuing privilege was much abused to the great detriment of individuals and to the public. Banks were started for the sole purpose of foisting worthless notes on a trusting public. The bank notes physically fell apart. What I mean by that is they were easily torn and mutilated. Banks would reissue their notes as long as they held together, and since many of them didn't, This gave profit to the bank and caused loss and destruction to the public. Counterfeit notes were also a big problem. To make matters worse, in 1857, the steamship Central America sank with over $1 million in gold and silver aboard, causing the Ohio Life and Trust Company to fail. This resulted in the bank suspending redemption of their notes on October 13, 1857, causing business failures of $291 million in 1857 alone. The split between North and South had been building up for a long time. A big part of the reason was the banking and financial piracy of the Northeastern elements. The South produced the wealth, while the North, like economic leeches, sucked the wealth out of the South. It had been the Southern voters that helped Andrew Jackson and Van Buren kill the Second Bank of the United States. But Southern cotton was paid for with foreign bills of exchange drawn on England. The market for foreign bills of exchange was in New York City. So the Southerners were convinced that Northerners were manipulating them in speculation in cotton paper. Northern industry barons wanted the Southerners to be their customers, selling them low-quality goods at higher prices than what the South was paying for English goods, while at the same time they wanted the Southerners' produced farm products at low prices. So, as you can see, it was not slavery that divided the South from the North. It was economics. Slavery was prevalent in all states until 1840. 17 of the 33 United States were slaveholding states. The importation of slaves was almost a total Jewish affair and was not outlawed until 1808. With the enactment of the 13th Amendment. The practice of indentured servants and slavery was common in all agrarian states. Indentured servants were slaves and all were white. The only difference was that the indentured servants were indentured for a set number of years, usually from 7 to 10. With duties on imports, the northern states had rigged the D.C. political system to their advantage. They had instituted a diabolical system on duties that, in effect, transferred the entire cost of government to the South. The southern states complained about this relentlessly, but were rebuffed by the northern states that controlled the majority of the legislature. In the 1860 election, there was a four-way race. Lincoln did not win a single southern state and had only 40% of the northern state's popular vote. When the Civil War started, there were only about $100 million in gold and silver in the country. And Chase's plan called for $381 million to fight the war. $80 million was coming from taxes and $300 million from borrowing. Then Lincoln started the draft, forcing men into the army, but you could buy your way out if you had $300. That would be about $5,746 in today's money. With that paid, you could hire a substitute to go into the army for you. Lincoln sent 30,000 troops to New York City to enforce his military draft. This started the largest civil insurrection in American history outside the Civil War itself. The rioters were overwhelmingly working-class men, primarily ethnic Irish. Geez, I can't seem to get away from those leprechauns today, can I? Oh well. Lincoln suspended habeas corpus and suppressed the media. He shut down over 300 Democrat papers, arrested and imprisoned over 14,000 editors and journalists. Lincoln had Congressman Clement Valid Dingham, arrested in violation of the Second Amendment, he confiscated guns and issued an arrest warrant for Chief Justice Roger Brooke Taney. When the Civil War broke out, it was just a matter of time before the banks suspended their payments in coin, and it would once again be left to the government to rescue the situation with greenbacks. Salmon P. Chase was the Secretary of the Treasury during the war, but he was more of an anti-slavery leader than a financial expert. Congress authorized borrowing $250 million in the form of banks and notes at the discretion of the Treasury Secretary. These interest-bearing notes were not legal tender, but were receivable for all public dues, taxes, etc. They were redeemable in gold and circulated freely with banknotes and gold until December 31, 1861. On that date, all the banks in the country suspended convertibility of their notes into coinage, and the gold market was closed for 2 weeks. It was Congressman E. G. Spaulding of Buffalo, New York, who introduced a bill to Congress to create legal tender money, called the greenbacks. Spaulding gave the following reasons why Congress should create the greenbacks. He said that gold and silver have been used throughout the world in all commercial transactions. The real intrinsic value of these metals is not as great as that fixed by governments. Without the government stamp, gold and silver would be simple commodities. Why should we go to Wall Street, State Street, Chestnut Street, or any other street begging for money? I am unwilling that this government should be left in the hands of any class of men, bankers or moneylenders, however respectable or patriotic they may be. The government is much stronger than any of them. They issue only promises to pay. Secretary of the Treasury Chase opposed the bill and held conferences with bankers to find alternate solutions. They had been working on a plan that would ultimately become the national banking system. Spaulding was for the national banking system, but thought it would take too much time to put into effect. He thought greenbacks were necessary, and that was his first step. Senator Howe of Wisconsin supported Spaulding's bill and attacked those pretending that the banks had sufficient gold and silver to lend to the government. He acknowledged that the government could borrow from the banks, but the government could not borrow coinage from the banks. The only thing the government could borrow would be not their money, but the banks' promises to pay money. He also affirmed that all paper currency have been and always will be irredeemable. It is a pleasant fiction to think them redeemable. I would not expose that fiction, he said, only that the great emergency which is upon us seems to me to render it more than usually proper that the nation should begin to speak the truth to itself, to have done with shams, and to deal with realities. On February 25, 1862, the legal tender law was passed in the House by 93-59. Previous Treasury notes, issued from 1812 and on, were always promises to pay and later redeemable in metal. The greenbacks were not paper promises to pay money later. They were money. Since they were not borrowed, there was not interest to pay on them, and they did not add to the national debt. The banks were successful in one respect. Congress had authorized the issue of $150 million in non-interest-bearing greenbacks. These were receivable for all dues and taxes to the United States, except import duties which had to be paid in coin. The greenbacks were also payable for all claims against the United States except interest on United States bonds, which was only payable in coin. And who held most of the United States bonds? The banks. For all other debts, both public and private, they were declared legal tender. Very soon, the country needed more greenbacks, so Congress authorized $150 million more dollars to be issued on July 7, 1862. $100 million more was issued in January 1863, and $200 million more were issued in 1864. Then, on June 30, 1864, Congress passed a law limiting the total greenbacks to $400 million plus another $50 million in fractional currency. That's a total of $450 million. That amount was never exceeded. But the bankers jumped right onto a loophole in the law. A person could deposit the greenbacks and get 6% compound interest-bearing bonds redeemable after 5 years and payable after 20 years in greenbacks. While the U.S. government authorized and issued $450 million in greenbacks, the private bankers absorbed the greenbacks and issued $1.49 in their own money in substitution for every greenback issued. Then, at their convenience, they converted the notes into bonds, which earned them interest in gold. While the interest was to be paid in coin, the principal was to be paid in greenbacks. Lincoln said little good about the greenbacks, and the greenbacks should not be viewed as his or the Republicans' program. He was in favor of the National Banking Act that was passed on January 17, 1863. He told Congress, "A uniform currency in which taxes, subscriptions to loans, and all other ordinary public dues, as well as all private dues, may be paid, is indispensable. Such a currency can be furnished by the banking associations organized under a general act of Congress." Lincoln also supported the banker's privilege to create money and regretted the fact that it was necessary to authorize so large an additional issue of U.S. banknotes. A Yale University professor, William Graham Sumner, was hesitant in his opinion of the value of the greenbacks. He didn't think the country knew how to do it. He did think the people of the United States had a patriotic attachment to the greenbacks because he thought it had saved the country. This narrator thinks only the damned Yankees had that patriotic attachment. He did venture to say that the value of a paper currency depends on the amount relative to the requirements of the country for the purpose of performing its exchanges. In other words, what he was saying was, limit the supply. Counterfeiters did not have much success in their profession either. They were easily detected by the paper, the printing, the engraving, and could not imitate the lathe work, especially on the back. The greenback dollar did fall to 58 cents against the gold dollar and went down to 36 cents on July 16, 1864. This was their low point. After Congress put a limit on their issue, they started climbing. And in 1878, greenbacks became freely convertible into gold, dollar for dollar, meaning they were every bit as valuable as gold. Every greenback that was ever printed was ultimately as valuable as its gold equivalent and became redeemable for gold coinage at full value. The Confederate money was not quite so successful. 39% of the South's revenue came from loans. This consisted of $712 million. The rest came from Confederate paper money. The Confederate money was not money, but was a promise to pay money later. Typically, the face of the Confederate notes have this phrase: 2 years after the ratification of a treaty of peace between the Confederate States and the United States of America, the Confederate States of America will pay to the bearer on demand X dollars. X could be either 5, 10, 500, or whatever the note's denomination was. The Confederates did not set any limits on their note issue. The Confederates issued a total of 1.55 billion of currency. The North issued only 450 million in currency. This is not to insult anyone's intelligence, but just to remind everyone, it takes 1,000 million to make 1 billion. By early 1865, the value of the Confederate dollar against gold was 5 cents. Let's talk a little about the National Banking Act. The National Banking Act was originally known as the National Currency Act. This act was passed by the Senate on February 25, 1863, by a vote of 23-21. This act attempted to clean up the banking business in America. The main goal was to create a single national currency and eradicate the problem of notes from multiple banks circulating all at once. State banks were very hostile to the arrangement. But then Congress placed a 10% annual tax on state banknote issues on March 1, 1865, and it was then that most state banks made plans to join the system. After the 10% tax on state chartered banknotes was decreed, their circulation dropped from 179.2 million down to 19.9 million. On June 30, 1863, the First National Bank of Philadelphia was the first to get a national charter. The National Banking Act of June 3, 1864 superseded the Banking Act of 1863. This act established federally issued bank charters, which took banking out of the hands of state governments. The National Banking Act created a system of national associations under the provision of the Treasury's newly created Comptroller of the Currency. A minimum of $50,000 was needed to launch a bank. A bank was required to purchase Treasury bonds in the amount of one-third of its paid capital, $30,000 minimum. A bank's indebtedness was limited to the amount of its paid-in capital in U.S. notes. Initially, each bank shareholder was made individually liable for the obligations of his bank up to twice the par value of his stock. The comptroller of the currency, not the individual banks, were responsible for printing bank notes. These were furnished to the individual banks with their own names on them up to 90% of the value of the government bonds the banks had deposited with the Treasury. A maximum of 300 million of such notes system-wide was decreed. 25% of the bank's combined circulating notes and deposits were required to maintain their reserves. 15% in small towns. National bank notes were made acceptable for most U.S. dues. Notes were to be received by all member banks at full value. The U.S. Treasury got an annual tax of 1% on a bank's average circulation plus 0.5% on its deposits and capital stock. Well, this is going to take us into the election of 1868, which Alexander Del Mar called one of the great monetary crimes in history. That'll be on our next program. Hope you join us then.